Peter began his investment career as a financial consultant with Shearson Lehman. Those of you who were here last year heard Peter make some predictions. Some of those predictions have come true. Now let's hear Peter Schiff.
State that I'm on the same side of the political spectrum as Barry. I mean, I believe in pretty much all the same things: a limited government, freedom, capitalism, sound money, the rule of law, private property, all the concepts believed by the founding fathers when they first created this republic. Unfortunately, few, if any, of those principles are applicable to the modern American economy. Now, I'm going to talk mainly today about the real estate market and the mortgage market, because I know that's the most relevant to the people in the room. But let me first talk a little bit about broader economic picture and where we are as a nation. You know, sure, when we were first formed as a republic a couple hundred years ago, the reason that we prospered and the reason we became the world's wealthiest creditor nation, I mean, this back in 1980 anyway, was because we had a comparative advantage in economic freedom. Taxes were much lower. The government was far less intrusive here in America than were the kings and the despots all over Europe. So the American colonies and our new country prospered. And we certainly borrowed a lot of money from the Europeans in the 19th century. But what we did with that money, we invested that money in factories, in infrastructure. We made capital investments. And by taking that money and building factories, we became the world's leading manufacturer and exporter of high-quality, low-cost consumer goods. Even though we eventually paid the highest wages in the world, American products were still the cheapest in price and the highest in quality. And because we made productive use of the money that we borrowed from the Europeans, we were able to repay the debt. You see, when you borrow money and build a factory, the factory produces consumer goods. The consumer goods are sold. We sold those consumer goods, automobiles, sewing machines, dishwashers. We sold all these goods to the Europeans, and we paid off our debts. And we went from a debtor nation to a creditor nation. And by 1980, we were not only the world's greatest creditor nation, but we had more foreign assets that were owned by Americans than all the other creditor nations in the world combined. We're the world's biggest lender around the world. We lent money, you know. Americans were wealthy lenders. We had a high savings rate. All that is different in modern America. Today, the United States is not the world's largest creditor nation. We're not even a creditor nation. We're the world's largest debtor nation. In fact, we owe more than all the other debtor nations of the world combined. We no longer flood the world with high-quality, low-cost manufactured goods. We flood the world with our paper currency, our IOUs, because we no longer possess the industrial might or the capability of producing those goods ourselves. Instead of being the world's biggest lender, we are the world's biggest borrowers. The United States routinely borrows from the poorest countries in the world. Now, according to modern economic thinking, right, this new state of affairs is somehow sustainable and a viable economic symbiotic relationship between America and the rest of the world. The relationship is America consumes and everybody else produces. America borrows and everybody else saves. And, you know, on the surface, potentially that argument can make sense. Right? Without American consumption, what would all these Chinese do for jobs? Well, as was pointed out by Barry, it's not about jobs. Right? It's about consumption. It's about standards of living. You don't want jobs just so you can work. You want jobs so that you can consume, that you can have a higher standard of living. The fact that Chinese get jobs in exchange for the products they give us doesn't do any good for the Chinese. The Chinese are perfectly capable of consuming their output themselves. They don't need their government to artificially suppress the exchange rate of the yuan so they can artificially elevate the value of the dollar so that Americans get to consume all the goods that the Chinese could have consumed had it not been for that monetary policy. But this current dynamic, where we don't save and we don't produce, is not viable. It's no more viable than the economic models that existed in the 1990s with respect to internet stocks or technology companies, where Wall Street had people believe that stock prices could rise regardless of the fact that the companies had no earnings, paid no dividends, without any regard to any fundamental measure of valuation. We were told that it was a new era, and we saw what happened there. And the same Wall Street economists that told us the internet era was a new era are now telling us that this current era of American consumption and global production is viable, and it's not. I'll give you a quick little analogy and then move on to another subject. I mentioned this on my website, and I've used it at various speaking engagements. But to describe this dynamic, assume that a group of castaways are stranded on an island. Let's say five of them are Asian, and one of them is an American. And when they're stranded on this island, they have to divvy up the workload. So one of the Asians is given the job of hunting and looking for meat. Another one is going to be fishing, trying to catch fish. Another one is in charge of scourging the island for vegetation. Still another one gets a job of looking for wood to build a fire and cook the meal. And then it comes down to the American. They say, well, you know, what job are we going to assign the American? Well, the American gets assigned the job of eating. And so at the end of the day, all these Asians gather around this big table after a hard day of foraging and hunting and fishing, and they prepare to feed this American, who did nothing all day but sun himself on the beach. He had a service economy. In any event, a modern economist who is looking at this little island's economy would say, oh, the American is the key to the whole thing. Without that American and his ravenous appetite, these poor Asians would have nothing to do all day. They'd all be unemployed. Well, the reality is, the Asians are perfectly capable of consuming the food themselves. Now, perhaps if they didn't have to spend all day long feeding this fat American, they wouldn't have to work as hard. Maybe they could pursue other interests that they had. The best thing that they can do to improve their own standards of living would be to kick that American off the island. Of course, when that happens, the American's in trouble, because now he doesn't have five Asians doing all of his work. You know, it almost reminds me a lot of that book, Tom Sawyer, you know, where Tom is able to convince all of his friends to whitewash his fence for him, and to not only do that, but to pay him for the privilege. Because Tom Sawyer got his friends so convinced that there was so much joy in this toil that it was worth paying him. And so he got the world to do his chores. And little did Samuel Clemens realize that that little passage in that book would one day form the basis of the global economy, where America convinced a billion Chinese to paint our fence and to pay us for the privilege. That's going to end. In fact, the Chinese have been talking this week about diversifying, you know, out of their $1 trillion in reserves. Of course, they can't diversify out of them. They're kind of stuck with them. But the minute they stop buying dollars, it's over. But let me just go back a little bit to where we are right now and how we got here most recently. Back in the 1990s, we had a bubble in the stock market. The bubble, like most bubbles, was created by Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve, and monetary policy that was too loose and too inflationary, even in the 1990s. The inflation that was created manifests itself in rising asset prices. And during that time period, there are a lot of malinvestments, as Mises calls them, made. A lot of that easy money funded a lot of cockamamie investments in telecommunications and internet companies that never should have seen the light of day. Ultimately, Greenspan started to raise interest rates and take away that monetary stimuli that he had supplied during the 90s. And eventually, the bubble burst. The Nasdaq lost 80% of its nominal value. And many of the companies that popped, the dot-com companies, lost 100% of their value. Now, I had predicted this in advance. In fact, when I used to talk to potential clients and clients in 1997 and 98 and 99 and tell them that the NASDAQ was going to lose 80 and 90% of its value, people thought that there's no way that that could possibly happen. I mean, people used to even tell me the government won't let that happen. Well, it happened. A lot of people today in the real estate market have the same idea when I tell them that property prices are going to drop 50, 60, 70, 80%. They don't think it can happen. They don't think the government will let it happen. Well, it happened in the stock market, and it's going to happen in the real estate market. There's very little difference. But anyway, we had the bursting of the technology bubble. Also, that coincided with the election of George Bush. Comes into office, 2000-2001, and the bubble that happened under Clinton bursts as soon as he's on the job. Now, very quickly to explain business cycles and how they work, contrary to what most people think, the boom is the problem. The bust is the solution. A boom is like an artificial high. Like if you take heroin and, you know, you shoot yourself up with heroin and, you know, it feels really great. At least that's what they tell me. But anyway, that's artificial. You want to get healthy, right? You want to, then you got to go to rehab or detox and you go cold turkey and you go through withdrawal. The withdrawal symptom is very unpleasant, very painful. Again, that's what I hear. But it's necessary if you want to remove these toxins from your system and get healthy. The same thing happens in the business cycle. When you have a central bank, and the central banks made the same mistakes in the 1920s, when you have monetary policy too inflationary, and you create an asset bubble, you create malinvestments, the malinvestments need to be purged. The economy needs to be rebalanced. Right? It's kind of like, you know, in the internet bubble, it's like let's say I ran a small restaurant, a circus comes to town, and all of a sudden, there's a lot more demand in my restaurant, and I misinterpret this. There's a false signal. I don't understand where this demand is coming from. So I expand. I hire more workers. I build on to the restaurant. Right? I think that there's a real increase in demand. Well, then all of a sudden, they pull up the stakes. The circus leaves town. Now it exposes the malinvestments. Now what do I got to do? I got to fire some people. I got to, you know, sublease some space. We go through a recession, a contraction. That's what's necessary. That's the cure. The problem was the false signals that were sent to me that I misinterpreted during the boom. Same thing happened during the 1990s. We had a lot of investments that were made based on false economic signals. A lot of tech companies and startup internet companies with lots of cash from IPOs were spending that money. That was not real demand. There was no profits there. You had all these companies like Intel and Lucent and Nortel, vendor financing all these companies. I mean, it was all a hoax. It was all a fraud. And when these companies started to go bankrupt and all these malinvestments were exposed, we were going to go through an economic downturn. That downturn should have been very severe. We should have had a very deep recession in 2002. We should have had a recession proportion to the boom that preceded it during the 1990s. But George Bush didn't want that recession happening on his watch. He wanted to get reelected. And Alan Greenspan, far from his Ayn Randian roots from the 1970s, is now a very political person and wanted to help his buddy get reelected. So what did they do? They combined with the worst ever combination of irresponsible tax and spending and monetary policy in our nation's history. You know, Barry talked about the problems in the 1970s. Well, the reason we had the 1970s was because of the 1960s. The 1960s was the Lyndon Johnson, guns and butter administration that had us fighting a war in Vietnam, sending men to the moon, fighting a war on poverty, while at the same time running big deficits to finance it all, ultimately having to leave the gold standard in the early 1970s, and as a result of all the inflationary monetary policy and the big government deficits that were monetized during the 1960s and 70s, we had oil prices going up 10 times, the dollar losing two-thirds of its value, gold going from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce. All the problems of the 1970s had their roots in the 1960s. Well, what we've seen with George Bush And Alan Greenspan is far worse than what we saw with Lyndon Johnson and William McKinley Martin during the 1960s. And of course, during the 1970s, America was on much firmer economic footing as the world's wealthiest creditor nation, as a manufacturing power. The fact that now, as an economy, we're in such lousy position economically, what we're about to experience in the decade ahead is going to be far worse than anything that we experienced in the 1970s. But anyway, so the recession that we didn't have in 1982, yeah, technically we had two quarters of negative growth. But during that supposed recession, we had record car sales and record home sales. Now that doesn't sound like any recession that I've ever experienced. Normally in a recession, these things go down. Also, a curious thing happened. At the end of the recession, consumers had more debt than when it began. Now that also doesn't make any sense for a recession, because in a recession, debt is paid down. People take on too much debt during the boom, they pay it off during the bust. During this bust, we went deeper into debt. Now what happened? Well, what this irresponsible monetary and fiscal policy did was to create the biggest consumption binge in world history, where American consumption, now greater than 70% of GDP, kept us from really having a recession. But all it did was push off the recession to some later date, after the re-election of George Bush, which is what they really cared about. We don't care if we create a bigger disaster. We just want to have a bigger disaster later, because then somebody else might be in office. So this is what they did. And so even though we had a downturn in the capital goods sector, the consumer went into debt and basically pushed off this recession until maybe starting in 2007. But it's going to be far worse as a result of all the unproductive debt that has been accumulated during the last 7 years. We are now running trade deficits of $65 billion a month, over $850 billion a year in debt. And what are we borrowing this money for? We're not borrowing it for the same things that we borrowed it for as a nation 100 years ago or 200 years ago. We're borrowing money to buy imported consumer goods. We're buying money for non-productive, depreciating consumer goods. Or we're borrowing money to just buy food or gasoline. We're borrowing money to take vacations, to remodel our kitchens, to put granite countertops in there. All this stuff is going to have to be paid. American consumers are now loaded up with debt. And the very nature of that debt, you know, a lot of people in this room understand that because you're in the mortgage industry. You know how many people own adjustable rate mortgages? And how many people have been able to extract equity from their houses as they've been appreciating? See, the dynamic behind this whole perverse situation was that as Americans spent money, we sent dollars abroad to pay for all the goods that we could no longer produce ourselves, foreigners were accumulating their IOUs. Because since we didn't have any goods that we produced that the Chinese or the Japanese wanted, they were stuck with all this paper. And so their central banks kept buying it. And what did they do with that, with the dollars? They bought U.S. treasuries. They bought mortgage-backed securities. They kept interest rates artificially low. Because in America, we should not have low interest rates. We've had negative savings rates for years. We have hardly any savings. Interest rates are the supply and demand of money. So we have minimal savings, and everybody's trying to borrow. Interest rates should be high. Why aren't they high? Because the rest of the world is loaning us their savings. And that's what's kept interest rates low. But as money kept coming back to the United States and buying our mortgage backs and buying treasuries, that kept real estate prices rising. The higher real estate prices rose, the more money Americans could borrow against their houses, the more imported goods we can afford to buy, the more dollars we sent abroad, and it was a process that kept perpetuating itself. And now, of course, the Chinese have over $1 trillion in foreign reserves. Not just the Chinese. The Japanese have nearly $1 trillion as well. And, of course, every other country in the world is collecting reserves. These represent goods that Americans have imported, but that we have not yet paid for. And the way you pay for goods is by exporting, right? Nobody exports for the sake of exporting. You don't export because you want to create jobs, right? The role of an economy is to eliminate jobs. People don't want to have to work. But the reason you export is to import. It's comparative advantage. But the problem is, we're not offering the world anything except our IOUs and the promise that at some point in the future, we're going to make good these IOUs with a manufactured product. But meanwhile, our ability to manufacture is diminishing with each passing day. And the world is going to wake up and understand this. But anyway, so getting back to where we are, so the consumer went into debt and spent a lot of money to keep this recession at bay. But all that consumption has a price of dramatic reduction in future consumption. You see, the only way that a society can really increase its future consumption is to save. And by definition, savings is under consumption. It's the lack of consumption. It represents self-sacrifice. But when you save and you reduce your consumption today, and you have money that you can invest, and you have compound interest and returns, ultimately you can enjoy enhanced future consumption. In America, we're indulging ourselves, or we have indulged ourselves, in the present at the expense of the future. And a nation is no different than an individual. Just like if there's one individual who works hard and doesn't take as many vacations, doesn't buy new cars, doesn't eat out a lot, saves a lot for his retirement, you know, he's building something for the future. You take another similar situation, a guy with the same income, but saves nothing, takes out a second mortgage on his house, you know, doesn't have a retirement account, you know, doesn't save for his kid's education, and just spends everything he earns. Initially, that person's economy looks pretty good if you simply measure it based on consumption, which is what we do when we measure our GDP. But you're not looking beneath the surface to say, at what expense is this consumption being funded? That's the big difference. And also, I wanted to just digress briefly on government statistics. You know, it was mentioned by Barry that, you know, the inflation rate is so low compared to what it was in the past. And one of the reasons for that, and probably the primary reason for that, is the way the government has changed the way it keeps score of the statistics. Now, back in the 1970s, they took housing prices out of the CPI. They used to be. Back in the 1970s, when we had that high inflation, housing prices were in there. They're not in there now. And in the mid-1990s, they introduced the concepts of hedonic adjustments and substitutions, which basically rendered the CPI worthless because the government could do whatever they want with it. You know, if a price of something went up, they don't have to count it. It's not a fixed basket anymore. And there's a lot of subjectivity in there where the government can take a look at something and say, well, the price went up 20%, but we think it's 30% better, so the price went down 10%. There's a lot of subjectivity that's in there now that wasn't in there back then. So when you just look at these numbers, right, and so there's no inflation. I mean, that's, you know, it's like a government weatherman is telling you that there's sunshine, but you look out the window and you can see that it's raining. Now, I'm not going to believe the government. Well, I'm going to believe my own eyes. And same thing with the productivity numbers. The productivity statistics were the result of hedonics. If we were becoming so much more productive, where are all the goods we're producing, and why can't I see that in the balance of trade? If we're so productive, where are the exports? Why do we have to import so many products from the rest of the world if we're more productive than they are? So you can't hide the facts. The government can lie all it wants with statistics, but the facts speak for themselves. You don't go from being the world's wealthiest creditor nation to being the world's poorest debtor nation and somehow claim that you're more productive than everybody else. It just doesn't make any sense. And the difference, of course, you know, when the world is accumulating assets and we accumulate liabilities, we have to make payments on those liabilities. And this is what's going to happen. So anyway, coming back to where we are as an economy, we had the real estate bubble that blew up. Americans took on a lot of debt. We spent a lot of money. Where are we now? Well, over the next year or two, you've got about $2 trillion of adjustable rate mortgages that are going to reset. Now, where are homeowners going to get the money to make these mortgage payments? It's not like they're sitting on a pile of cash. You know, in fact, most people that own homes, when they qualified for their mortgages, they bought the biggest monthly payment that somebody would approve them for, even at that low rate. So if they got a teaser rate of 6% or 5%, they maxed themselves out. They're spending 40% of their income on their mortgage now at the low rate. How are they going to afford to make these payments when the rate's 8% or 9%? Well, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to cut back spending on anything else. No more eating out, no more shopping at Walmart, no more cable TV, no more cell phone. I got to make this mortgage payment. Well, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. The minute Americans stop spending, because all their surplus money is now going to make interest payments to the Chinese and the Japanese, or to pay, you know, higher costs for gasoline or food, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. A lot of people in America earn their living on discretionary spending. In fact, most of us earn their living on discretionary spending. A lot of people are going to lose their jobs because Americans are struggling to make mortgage payments instead of spending money on what they're spending it on now. Of course, a lot of Americans got their spending money from home equity extractions. As their real estate was going up, they kept borrowing against it. Well, you can't borrow against it anymore when all the equity has already been borrowed out, or real estate prices start to fall. Interest rates on the long-term rates are still not any higher than they were 4 or 5 years ago. But what's higher are the short-term rates. And that's where these adjustable rate mortgages are all set at the short term. Also, of course, a lot of people don't realize this too, but one of the things that the Clinton administration did and the Bush administration was we put the entire country on an adjustable rate mortgage. The U.S. government used to finance its borrowings with 30-year paper. Now the average maturity on the national debt is under 3 years. It's almost $9 trillion in debt as an adjustable rate mortgage. So as interest rates rise, it's going to impact the federal budget. And there's probably going to be quite a bit of tax increases in the pipeline because of the larger deficits that are in our future. Of course, that means homeowners are not only going to have to face higher mortgage payments, but they're going to have higher taxes as well, in addition to higher costs for food and groceries and things like that. So we're going to have a very severe recession as a result of that contraction of consumer spending. Also, Americans are going to have to rebuild their savings, replenish their savings. For the last 5 or 6 years, a lot of Americans felt, why save? I own a house. I don't need to save. In fact, a lot of Americans said, I don't even need a job. I own a house. You go out to California, about 2 years ago, the average person buying a home in California believed that house was going to appreciate by 20% a year for 10 years. Now, the average price at the time was $500,000, which meant that person buying that house believed that he was going to earn $100,000 a year for the next 10 years. Actually, not more than that, appreciation, actually $3 million over 10 years. Because that's what 20% compounded for 10 years would take a $500,000 house and turn it into a $3 million house. So the average person in California who might maybe made $50,000 or $60,000 a year believed that by buying a house, he was going to have an extra $250,000 a year in income just because he owned a house. Why even have a job? You know, people used to buy a house because they can afford it. Now they buy a house because they need the money. And if you need more money, you buy a vacation house. People forget that real estate depreciates, that houses have to be maintained, that they cost money. They forgot that when they were speculating. In fact, the people who were buying real estate made the exact same mistakes as the people who were buying stocks. You know, when people were buying stocks in the 1990s, the reason they lost money was not because stocks are bad investments. If you buy a stock at the right price, it's a good investment. The reason they lost money is because they forgot. They overpaid for stocks. It's overpaying for stocks that makes them a bad investment. How do you know you're overpaying? Well, you look at the dividend yield. If you don't get a good dividend, then you're overpaying for the stock. Well, how do you know if you're overpaying for real estate? You look at the rents. And the rent's not just supposed to cover your expenses. You don't invest to break even. You can get 5% in a government bond, right? If you can't get 7 or 8 or 9% return on a piece of property, then you're overpaying. Well, what's been happening in California and other parts of the country, investors, they're really speculators, were buying property. Not only was there no investment return, but there was negative cash flow. People would buy a piece of property and pay $1 million for it, where the rents that they could collect were less than the mortgage payments on the property or the taxes or the maintenance. Less. Now, why were they doing that? Well, because they figured they would make it up on the appreciation. But they didn't bother to ask themselves, why should an asset that's so overpriced that it produces a negative return, why should that asset appreciate? It just should collapse. But the people who were buying real estate and are still buying real estate were making the exact same mistakes that people made in the stock market. They were not basing their investment decision based on the fundamental value of the asset. They were basing it on the belief that prices would rise, on the belief that there would always be a greater fool willing to accept more losses because there was no such real estate would always go up. It was a sure thing. Just buy it. It doesn't matter what you pay for it. It doesn't matter what the rent is, because it's always going to appreciate. Well, people are now starting to find out that that's not going to happen. And also, you know, one of the reasons people say, well, prices are just going to level off. That's impossible. Prices can't level off. You know, it's like I can't hold a balloon up in the air, a beach ball up in the air like this, and take my hand away and expect the ball to stay there. Why are real estate, why did they get so high in the first place? Why did they get there? Well, they got there because of the artificially low interest rates that existed. Well, those artificially low interest rates are not there anymore. Rates are still not high, but they're not nearly as low as they were. And without those very low rates, these prices are impossible because people can't get payments that low. They also were there because of the complete abolition of lending standards. Well, that process is starting to reverse itself. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But standards are starting to tighten, and they're going to get a lot tighter. And number three was the speculative mentality of the buyer. Now, one of the reasons that people were buying real estate, let's say someone in California who believed this house was going to appreciate by 20% a year. Let's assume my income is $5,000 a month, but I'm going to buy a house where the mortgage payment is $4,000 a month. Well, no sane person would commit 80% of his income to making a mortgage payment. But wait a minute. If I'm expecting that house to appreciate by 20% a year, my real income isn't the $50,000 I earn as a policeman. It's the $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year I'm going to earn as a homeowner. So they take a look at that money and they figure that's my real income. So they get one of these no-doc loans, one of these liar's loans that you guys came up with, and they say, my income is $150,000 a year. I qualify for that loan. And of course, they pay a little bit higher interest penalty because they didn't want to document their loan. And of course, anybody who can document their loan would do it. Why would anybody that actually had the income not document it? I mean, if they file a tax return, you know, they're lying. But they don't care. And I mentioned this as a paradox, that even though real estate prices were high, rising real estate prices makes real estate affordable. Because if somebody believes they're going to get paid $100,000 a year for owning a house, right, that offsets the actual cost of the mortgage, of the taxes, of the maintenance. But the minute a more realistic outlook for the future price is in the mind of the buyer, the minute he can't anticipate that windfall, all of a sudden the true cost of home ownership becomes apparent to the buyer. And he's not going to pay these prices. But more importantly than the buyers are the lenders who are not going to lend. And the big part of this problem has been from the lender's perspective. You know, traditionally, the way people bought a house is they went to a bank, and the bank wrote them a mortgage. And the bank held that mortgage for 30 years. And so the bank had a big vested interest in the loan getting repaid. So how did the bank ensure that that loan was repaid? Well, it was very careful about who it lent money to and under what terms money was lent. Buyers needed a 20% down payment. Why they need a down payment? Well, so they wouldn't cut and run at the first sign of trouble, number one. Number two, because the ability to save a down payment said something about an individual's character and their ability to save and pay for the ongoing expenses of home ownership. And number three, if the home went into foreclosure, the bank had a cushion. Right? There was something there. Also, when the appraiser was hired, it was hired by the bank, and the bank wanted that appraisal to be accurate because that was what it needed if there was a default. It had to know, what is this asset worth? Because I'm going to carry this note on my books for 30 years. If this guy doesn't pay, what can I sell this property for? So there was a lot of scrutiny, and there was a lot of soundness in the lending practices. And, of course, the lenders would say, well, I'm not going to lend any more than, you know, 30%. I'm not going to let somebody borrow or commit to a home where the payments are more than 30% of their income because they know what can reasonably be handled. And of course, they wanted the borrower to fully document that loan. Yes, we want proof. I'm not just going to accept your word for what you make. Prove it. Now, how does the lending industry work today? Well, you've got this huge moral hazard built in, and a lot of it was created by government and the guaranteed mortgages of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But what happens is you've got a whole bunch of people in this room that are lending money. But when you lend the money, does anybody in this room keep that loan? No, it gets sold. It gets repackaged, and these other companies buy them. And then they repackage them again, and they get sold to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. That creates these collateralized mortgage obligations, or they sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that just buy them if they're conforming loans. So what happens is the lenders just want to make loans. They don't care if they're ever repaid because they're not going to own the loan. Now all of a sudden, when they hire an appraiser, do they want an appraiser who's going to give an accurate appraisal? No. They want an appraiser who's going to appraise the property high enough to fund this loan. The appraisers know that. The appraisers want to get jobs. They want to get hired. Who hires them? The mortgage lenders. If a guy keeps coming in with low appraisals, he's not going to get any work. So the appraisers have an incentive to inflate the value of the home. Of course, the buyers, they don't care. They just think it's all going to go up. So they just want to close on this thing. In fact, back in California, when I was living there, I mean, the house would go on the market, and there'd be 100 offers, and people would write in with sob stories. You know, please sell me your house. I mean, I go to church every week. You know, it was like a gravy train. All you had to do was own this house, and you were home free. Done. You were rich. You didn't have to work anymore. So all they want to do is buy this home. Now, when people used to buy homes with a 30-year mortgage, the reason that it made sense to buy a home, the reason that it was an investment, was because you paid off the house. After 30 years, you lived rent-free. Now you could retire. You'd burn your mortgage because you no longer had any debt. And the return on home ownership was that rent you paid to yourself and the fact that you're now out of debt. Well, today people aren't buying homes. They're renting them from the banks. They have interest-only loans, or worse yet, negative amortization loans, where they go deeper into debt every year. You know, all they're doing is hoping that the appreciation bails them out, that they build equity not by paying off the loan, but by the house just magically appreciating in value. That doesn't happen. I mean, it can happen for a short period of time, but it doesn't happen over the long run. Let me tell you a little bit about the subprime market, which I'm actively involved in shorting right now, but to show you what's going to happen. The way this subprime market works, and I didn't even realize this until I did the research to start shorting this stuff, but 65% of the subprime mortgage market, 65% of that, of those bonds, of those mortgages where a guy, stated income, no doc, negative am, risky loans, 65% of those things are repackaged by Wall Street and rated AAA. AAA. The equivalent of sovereign debt of the best credit quality governments in the world. How can it possibly be that 65% of the subprime mortgages that are issued get a rating of AAA? How can that be? Well, the reason is Wall Street creates these tranches of CMOs, $1 billion worth of mortgages. And the way they structure it is they insulate the top 65% from losses by saying all the losses from interest and principal are going to go to these riskier tranches. The riskiest tranche, which represents 1% of the market, 10 million face, that risky tranche gets all the losses first. So that tranche has to be wiped out before any other tranche loses one dime of interest, let alone principal. Now, that particular piece of paper is rated BBB- and yields about 7.75% right now. That piece of paper should be rated F, and it will go to zero, as will several other tranches above it. Right now, one of the big trades that is starting on Wall Street, and which I'm participating in, is shorting that tranche. A lot of the brokerage firms now are creating derivative instruments where you can do these credit default swaps, and you can bet on those things defaulting. Now, what's going to happen as more and more people put this trade on, the price of those bonds is going to start to fall. As the price of those bonds, those risky tranche bonds, falls, the yields are going to shoot up. When that happens, it's going to make it impossible for Wall Street to collateralize this debt because it's going to be too expensive. Rates are going to rise, and the bottom is going to drop out of the subprime market. And, of course, the subprime market is at the margin determining home prices. It's these buyers who are lying about their income, who are overstretching themselves, who are coming in here, and it's been made possible through this credit market, where the buyers of these instruments are somehow believing they're insulated from losses, and people were willing to buy these risky tranches. Once they don't want to buy those tranches anymore, you're going to start to see a big, big drop or a big rise in interest rates, and that whole market is going to shut down. Because all of a sudden, when the mortgage people who are buying these bonds from you guys, when they can't resell them because Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley won't buy them anymore because they can't sell them, then it's over. There's no more market. There's no more secondary market for these products. And credit really starts to contract. And it's almost like a self-perpetuating spiral, because the minute you take away the credit and you make it harder for people to borrow money to buy property, well, you have fewer buyers. Of course, a lot of property is going to be coming on the market over the next year or two, because as I said, when these adjustable rate mortgages reset, a lot of people are going to be in a situation where they can't make these payments. Even if they cut back everywhere, they can't make these payments. And of course, a lot of them are going to be unemployed if they happen to work in the service sector and they've lost their jobs because other people have cut back. So a lot of properties are going to come on the market. If you think there's a high inventory now, wait a while. Who's going to buy these properties if there's no credit flowing? And besides, everybody already owns houses. I mean, we have home ownership right now is at an all-time record high. You know, there's never been more people that own homes. I mean, look at all the homes that are bought by single women in their 20s. You know, it used to be back in, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if two people got married, they were both renters. They got married and they bought a house. Now two people get married, they're both homeowners. They've got to sell one of them. You know, the whole dynamic. And one of the reasons this downturn is going to be particularly severe, right, in, you know, when people are stretched to the limit on their mortgages and they have no savings. You know, back in the 1950s or 1960s, a guy lost his job. It wasn't a big crisis. You know, he had a stay-at-home wife. She can get a part-time job. He can get a part-time job. They had plenty of savings. They had a fixed-rate mortgage. I mean, it wasn't adjustable. They could get by. No big deal. It wasn't a crisis. Today, most people who have a home, you've got two breadwinners. And even if one of them loses a job, they're done. They can't make the payments. The only reason they were able to do it before was because, okay, they borrowed some more money. They went to that ATM and extracted some equity. But all of a sudden, when you can't do that, you know, and a lot of the people who bought homes, you know, I used to laugh, all the people would be buying these adjustable rate mortgages. And they'd be asking a survey, well, why are you buying an adjustable rate mortgage? Why don't you get a 30-year fixed? Well, I'm only going to live in a house for 2 or 3 years. Well, I would think, well, then why are they buying it? I mean, if you're going to live in a house for 2 or 3 years, just rent. Well, they were buying it because they were speculating. They said, I'm going to buy this house, it's going to go up, but I'm going to sell it in 3 years. Well, what happens when it doesn't go up? And what happens when the mortgage interest rate now resets and you can't afford it? Well, you just walk away. In fact, what a lot of people didn't realize, and I used to read a lot of articles about all the risks of nothing down mortgages and zero down mortgages. And I would say, yeah, you're right, there are a lot of risks. But the papers had it wrong. The risks weren't being borne by the borrower. They were being borne by the lender. That's the whole idea. When you put nothing down, you got nothing to lose. It's the lender that's taking all the risk. And of course, when you give somebody that situation, where you tell somebody, hey, you can buy this house for $500,000. You can lie about your income. You can put nothing down. And if it goes up, it's all yours. That $2 million, yours. You can borrow it out tax-free every year, you know, and it's all your money. And if it goes bad, just move out. You have nothing to lose, especially if they took a negative AM, teaser rate, adjustable rate mortgage, where for the first 2 or 3 years, the mortgage payment was really low. It might have even been lower than what they were paying in rent. And so they figured, what the hell? You know, in fact, for a while in California, it was much easier to buy a house than rent, because renters, the landlords were, you know, they wanted you to prove your income. The lenders didn't need you to prove your income to you can't have a stated income rent. They always do a credit check. They always check on your stuff. Landlords wanted first month. They wanted last month. They wanted a security deposit. Hell, you didn't need any of that to buy a house. You know, so, I mean, a lot of people are just making this gamble because we put that in their minds. Of course, this is all going to unravel. This is all going to unravel. And as real estate prices start to fall, right, and you say, wait a minute, you know, when they rose, look what's happened to real estate prices. I mean, what have they done? I mean, when people talk about, oh, we've created all this wealth. I mean, Barry mentioned all the wealth that we've created. We really haven't created wealth. What's happened is the value of our assets are now appraising at a higher price. But prices can change over time. The Nasdaq was 5,000, then it was 1,000. The stocks were still the same stocks. The perception of the value is all that changed. So the reason that real estate prices were so elevated was supply and demand, right? Everybody wanted to buy, And nobody wanted to sell. Why would you sell a house? It just kept going up. If you needed money, just borrow against it. And everybody wanted to buy because it was your ticket to Easy Street. If you were renting, you were an idiot. You were throwing away money. You got to buy. So everybody wanted to buy and nobody wanted to sell. So prices went up. Well, what's going to happen? All of a sudden, nobody wants to buy anymore. Who wants to buy houses when they're falling in value? Who wants to lend money to buy houses? You see, when real estate prices were rising, the lenders didn't care. Default, who cares about default? If the guy defaults, we'll sell the house and we'll make a profit. But when prices are falling and lenders are worried about defaults, they're going to contract their lending. I'm not going to lend money out. Nothing down. Are you kidding me? You know, I need 20% down. Of course, when you require a down payment, it makes it much more difficult for someone to buy a house, especially when the prices are so high. You know, if the average house is $500,000 and now you need $100,000 down, the average guy doesn't have that money. It was the fact that they abolished the down payment that made so many people able to pay these prices. In fact, there was a whole lending industry constantly lowering their standards, which enabled prices to rise. Historically, the lenders provided a check on home prices. And if you look at a chart, you go back like 100 years, and you look at the price of houses in the United States until 2000, it matched the CPI. That's basically all that happened is housing prices basically stayed even with the CPI, but only because the owners of those houses spent a bunch of money every year maintaining them. If you didn't maintain it, if you didn't fix the roof, if you didn't fix the pipe, if you didn't do all that stuff, your house lost value. It was only because you kept it current and you maintained it that it kept pace with inflation. It wasn't until 2000 it went off the charts because something weird happened. And this is all going to be corrected. But also, you know, when pendulums swing, they don't swing way to one side and then come and stop in the middle. They go all the way to the other way first. It takes a while before you find a balance. So as expensive as real estate got, right, that's how cheap it's going to get. People are going to be completely amazed at the prices that houses are going to be selling for in a few years. Amazed. Just as amazed as the people were when they saw their shares of stocks go from 200 to nothing or practically nothing. It's the same thing. It's the same dynamic. Because you're going to have lots of sellers. You're going to have very little buyers. You're going to have a lot of foreclosures. You're going to have a lot of developers going bankrupt. You're going to have a lot of speculators. You know, I know lots of people own 5, 6, 7, 8 houses. You know, maybe they've had negative cash flow on these houses. Their negative cash flow is going to get bigger because a lot of them are refinanced with adjustable rate mortgages. You know, I know people who own many, many houses, and when they qualified on their loans, they wrote owner-occupied. I mean, there are people that have 7, 8, or 9 owner-occupied homes in different states. I mean, everybody is looking the other way at these speculators buying houses. But, you know, they're all going to come on the market. Look where we are here in Las Vegas. I mean, there are so many condominiums that have been built in this town that nobody lives in. Their lights are never on. I mean, they weren't even bought with the intention of living in them. Some of them are so small, it's like nobody would even want to live. But why would you even want to buy a condo in this town? Look at all the hotel rooms. And they're pretty reasonably priced. Why would you want to own a condo? Well, the only reason people wanted to buy condos was because they thought they could flip them to somebody else. But as this huge supply of houses comes back on the market from speculators who got caught. And a lot of people who are speculators are homeowners. Just because you own your home and live in it doesn't mean you're not a speculator. If you bought a house using an adjustable rate mortgage, knowing that you can't afford to make the payments when they reset, you're a speculator. If you bought a house planning on selling it in 2 or 3 or 4 years, you're a speculator. That's all you are. So we had rampant speculation in this housing market, much more so than we had in the stock market. But the bigger problem is how intertwined the economy and the stock market are. Because if you look at that housing wealth or those housing prices as the source of this consumption and the collateral for all of our borrowing from abroad, this is the problem. Now, of course, when prices start to fall, people think, well, the Fed will just cut interest rates and save the day with some rate cuts. It's not going to happen. Once the bubble bursts, cutting interest rates doesn't stop it. Greenspan brought interest rates all the way down to 1%. It didn't stop the Nasdaq decline. It happened anyway. Once money starts moving out of an asset, it moves out of that asset. Low interest rates aren't going to do anything. And the bigger problem, though, is the dollar. Right now, as I said, the dollar, I think, is poised for a substantial decline. Once the dollar really starts to fall, interest rates are going to have to rise and rise sharply to shore it up because we have no savings. We've got to pay the Europeans and the Asians to hold their savings in our currency. And when our currency starts to fall, the only thing that we can do to entice them to hold it is to pay them higher and higher rates of interest. And in 1980, when Ronald Reagan came in and we tried to stop the decline of the dollar, which lost two-thirds of its value during the 1970s, we did it, but we did it by putting short-term interest rates up to 20%. Now, imagine what would happen to the U.S. economy if interest rates were even half of 20%. What would the interest on the national debt be? Oh, $1 trillion a year. Where the hell is the government going to get that money? Imagine if people's home mortgages were now based on a overnight Fed funds rate of 10%. I mean, could anybody make their payments? Where would this economy be? What would happen to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Would they still be around? You know, those tranches that we're shorting, according to these, to the statistics, all it takes is about 5% a 5% loss rate on these mortgage, collateralized mortgage obligations. Just 5 cents on the dollar is lost, and it wipes out that tranche completely. Completely, to zero. I think about a similar amount of losses would wipe out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And of course, the government has an implied guarantee of all that debt. And of course, you know, Barry talked about inflation and how inflations have destroyed countries. It's not inflation that destroys countries, it's governments. Because governments create inflation. Governments create inflation by creating money. And that's the situation that we're staring at. Because as the housing bubble implodes, as the economy implodes, as these entities go bankrupt, like the Pension Guarantee Corp, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the incentive to monetize that and for the politicians to print enough money to try to make good these promises is tremendous. It's the same type of incentives that the Argentines faced, that the Germans faced in the Weimar Republic. That's what led to the inflation. And that's something that potentially we're staring at. I hope it doesn't get to that worst case scenario. But unfortunately, that type of inflation is the only thing that's going to stop nominal real estate prices from collapsing. If we don't have that, if the government does the right thing, we will see real estate prices decline dramatically. Not only will all the gains of the last 6 or 7 years be completely erased, but prices will be lower than they were in 2000. Lower by a considerable margin. And as I said, you know, if it doesn't happen, if we have inflation, it really doesn't matter if you live in a $1 million condo, if you have $10,000 worth of groceries in your refrigerator. Relative prices don't matter, right? And that's what might happen if we just have enough inflation so that nominal housing prices don't collapse. But real housing prices have to go down. And that's real housing prices relative to the price of everything else. Am I out of time? Anyway, thanks.
All right, you heard it from the bear. Let's bring back the bull. Oh, maybe not quite that type of bull. What we're going to do for you now, folks, is give you an opportunity to ask these two gentlemen some questions. The rules of engagement will be that you can go to one of the two microphones out here in the center. Please make your question straight and to the point. We don't want to hear any long stories. Unfortunately, we don't have a long period of time. So straight to the point questions, direct them to one or the other of our guests, and then the other guest will have a rebuttal, and the rebuttals will be, the answers and rebuttals are limited to 3 minutes. First question, Paul Donahue.
You see it.
Well, first of all, I think the demographic argument is a ruse. It's very similar to the arguments that were perpetuated by the analysts during the 1990s to explain the valuation model. Eyeballs and click-throughs. They were always trying to, they didn't want to admit it was a bubble, so they tried to rationalize it. The demographic argument is flawed. I mean, the demographics are no different than they were in the 1980s and the 1990s. I mean, there isn't a bigger influx of population. In fact, I remember having an argument with someone in California who was talking to me about the demographic argument, and I had to show him that California was actually losing population. That he was actually wrong in what was happening with the demographics. This has been a credit bubble, pure and simple. It has nothing to do with the fundamentals. If the fundamentals were in charge, prices never would have risen to these levels. You know? And so I am focusing on the fundamentals. That's what I'm doing. That's what I did in the 1990s with the stock market. I wasn't distracted by all the propaganda by the Wall Street community about why to justify this mania. Just like I'm not being distracted now by David Lehrer or all the propaganda coming out of the real estate industry about why this is justified. It's not justified. It's a pure and simple mania. You want to look at manias, look at, there have been manias all throughout history. You know, you got, again, we had one on the internet, but we had, you know, you go back to tulip bulbs or the you know, you can, Mississippi bubble or all kinds of things and railroads in the 1900s. It's a mania and it's always the same type of stuff. As far as where are the opportunities, you know, there's a lot of opportunities now. If in the real estate market, the opportunities are probably to stay away from it and maybe buy some things when they get very cheap. Don't buy too early because they're going to get a lot cheaper than you think. In the meantime, you want to keep your wealth out of the U.S. dollar. As I said, the dollar is going to lose a lot of value. If it lost two-thirds of its value during the 1970s, it can probably lose three-quarters or 90% of its value in the next 10 years, which means foreign assets will go up 5 to 10 times. So if you have your assets, if you have your wealth in euros, in yuan, in Australian dollars, you know, if you own other assets, then you'll have a lot more purchasing power to buy very depressed U.S. real estate in several years.
All right. Dr. Asmus.
The Brookings Institute did a big home study just recently, and here is what they said. A study funded by the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program indicates that by the year 2030, about half the buildings in which Americans live, work, and shop will have been built after the year 2000. The nation had about 300 billion square feet of built space in 2000, but by 2030 we'll need 430 billion square feet of space to accommodate growth. While 82 billion of that will be in the form of replacement of existing space, 131 billion will be new space. Once again, to review that, half of the buildings that we will be occupying in the year 2030 have not been built yet. It must occur to someone that there's great opportunity yet in building some more. Recently, Harvard, I don't quote them very often, but their big housing report, the most immediate, this is from that report, the most immediate risk to the housing market now comes from the rise in interest rates, the erosion of affordability after years of strong house appreciation, and the growing inventory of both new and existing homes for sale. But unless the broader economy stumbles and job losses mount, and of course that's what Peter's worried about too, home sales and construction activity will likely dip only modestly. Over the longer term, the outlook for the housing market is favorable. With household growth accelerating and second home demand climbing, the number of conventional homes completed and manufactured homes placed in the coming decade should easily exceed the 18 million added between 1995 and 2004. As a result, housing production should average more than 2 million units annually over the next 10 years. And just one more quote, and this is from someone in your industry. His name is Douglas Duncan, chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association. He observes that 34% of American homeowners have no mortgage debt, and 48% have fixed rate mortgages. That leaves 18% with adjustable rate mortgages, of which 6 percentage points are probably subprime. He doesn't see how these numbers add up to a major calamity for the economy. 30 more seconds? No. No.
Let's go to the next question.
Okay.
Next question. We want to be sure we get a money. Yes, sir.
Yes, Peter. As a lender myself and a property owner, and also a writer about real estate and what's going on, should I just slip my wrists?
No. I mean, there's no reason to slit your wrist. I mean, you know, this is what's going to happen. But, you know, the statistics, I want to get, you know, the fundamentals here. You know, the idea that there's all this demand for second homes, right? Second homes are in demand because people buying them are buying them because they think they're going to get rich on them. The reality is the demand for second homes is going to collapse. All these vacation homes are going to come on the market when people realize that it's cheaper to stay in a hotel when you take a vacation than to buy a piece of property. Also, all the home construction that's going on is being done by public builders who are building homes to maintain their stock prices so the insiders can keep selling shares even though there's no demand. You can look, I'm living in New England now. There are for sale and for rent signs all over the place. I mean, there are so many unoccupied homes. If there really were a shortage, I mean, there's so many homes, no one has never lived in them. No one's ever going to live in them. They're empty houses. You can rent where I am now in New England, I know in California, houses that appraisers will tell you are worth $4 and $5 million. You can rent them for $6,000 and $7,000 a month. It is absolutely ridiculous. And the people who wrote that, whatever you were reading, are not looking at those fundamentals. This is a huge, huge glut. Prices are going to collapse. All you can do, instead of, slitting your wrists, you can say, look, this is what's going to happen. So what can I do? How can I change my business, in advance of what's going to happen, rather than just being surprised by it? I mean, obviously, there will be some opportunities. But look, this industry is going to change. A lot of people were stockbrokers in 1990, 2000. A good friend of my mother's was a shoe salesman all her life, and she got a job at Merrill Lynch in 1998. She was selling tech stocks. One day I called her up and I said, Carol, here's the name of some good oil stocks. Why don't you recommend these oil stocks to your clients? And she said, well, look, I'm a technology broker. I don't buy oil stocks. I said, well, what do you know about technology? You're a shoe salesman. I said, do you know what the PEs are in those tech stocks? And she said, well, PEs don't matter. Of course, she's baking cookies now. She doesn't work at Merrill Lynch anymore. But so a lot of people came into the mortgage industry in the last 4 or 5 years. They're not going to be in this industry in another 4 or 5 years. But obviously, some people will be there. I'm still a stockbroker. There are still stockbrokers around. But you have to understand how you can reorganize your business and what you can do differently in light of what's going to happen.
I think that's what we're looking for, Barry.
Peter, I think the audience has to understand that what Peter's doing a bit is in the vernacular of your... He's selling to the book. His company, Euro or whatever... is big into commodities, gold, and currencies. So it's in Peter's great self-interest that people look at commodities, gold, and currencies. Maybe a few other things, but that's the biggest part. So I understand that is where, that's the prism by which he views the world. Now, you can prove anything that you want with statistics one way or the other or the other. So there's no doubt about that. But you have to understand where he's coming from. And by the way, my gut feel about that is very risky. A portfolio of commodities, currencies, and gold is a very, very risky portfolio. We've just come through a 4 or 5 bull market in commodities. And so he's trying to tell us that it's probably going to go on and on. And I would suggest it's not. Look at Peter's very upset about $70 a barrel of oil, et cetera. The point is $70 a barrel for oil is not the problem. $70 a barrel for oil is the solution. Why? Because markets respond. $70 a barrel of oil brings in all kinds of alternatives. And so what he's saying is oil prices are now came down a little bit, back up. I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I think they're going to continue to move down. Why? Again, that's how markets work. Now, have some mistakes been made with those low interest rates? Of course they've been made. Is there a bubble in some markets? Perhaps Phoenix, Southern California, Florida? No question about it. Did my aunt pay a big price by putting all her money in one technology stock in the late 90s and call me and say, I'm a millionaire, and then all of a sudden, she's not a millionaire, she's in poverty? Of course, that happens. There's going to be some people that get burned on this thing. The ones that Peter described, there are going to be some people that are hurt. But as far as the longer term, to imply that America isn't a producing nation, my opinion, just is not factual.
All right. I'm a mortgage broker.
Really important because I take exception to that comment about my talking my book or somehow that what I'm saying is influenced by... my investment approach. My investment approach is dictated by what I believe. I own the company. Euro Pacific Capital recommends whatever I want. And so if I was bullish on the U.S. and I was bullish on technology stocks, my clients would be loaded up with Cisco and Microsoft. In fact, I would have made a lot more money during the 1990s when all my friends were getting rich telling their clients to buy all the dot-coms. I was taking the hard road. I was telling people, no, this is wrong. You don't buy these stocks. This is a bubble. That was hard to do. I talked people out of that. And so my firm reflects myself. And I'm just, the fact that I've been recommending for people to buy foreign stocks for the last 8 years, and the fact that they've made 30 or 40% a year doing it, is because of my foresight. And believe me, the minute I get bullish on the U.S. market and the U.S. dollar will be the minute I stand up here and tell people to buy U.S. stocks. My firm is not, it's not like all I can tell people to do is buy oil and gold. The fact that I told people to buy oil when it was at $17 a barrel, or gold when it's $250 an ounce, is to my credit.
Well, let's bring this back, if you would,
Peter. Not like I'm, but he's saying
I understand your rebuttal.
I'm not.
Let's bring this back to this group. I'm a mortgage broker. I'm from Phoenix. I own four homes. Do I slip my wrist before I leave here today? Or, Barry, do I expand my business because I'm going to need more loan officers and I'm going to need to train more people?
Well, I surely cannot say you want to expand at this time. There's no question that there's going to be some softening in the economy in the year 2007. And a big reason why that economy is going to soften some is because of the very thing that Peter is talking about. We will pay a price. I would argue it's got not going to come nowhere near the severity of what Peter shared with you. So I think you'd all do well to invite us back next year and the year after that and the year after that, because we will watch this thing play out. The problem, Peter, that I have is when you say things like you do about Greenspan and other people, and people in the market, you're saying that they don't adjust. That's exactly what markets are about. We will now go through adjustment. We are going through, and there's no question there's a softening. There's no question that 2007 will be a little bit of a weak economy. But understand something: we have just once again come through 12, 14 quarters of a 4% growth. Now let me put that in perspective. Under the Ronald Reagan years, it was 3.4%. Under the Bill Clinton years, it was 3.6%. I mean, this economy is humming. The fact of the matter is people want to come here. The fact of the matter is the automobile plants throughout the world want to locate in America. Right now, out of Jackson, Mississippi, Infiniti built one of the biggest automobile plants in the world. Just out of San Antonio, Toyota is building one of the biggest automobile plants in the world. Why? We're producing one-third of the world's wealth. That is why.
All right.
And the point about outsourcing, look, a comparative advantage says that if China can do some of the manufacturing, let them be. Don't tell me that China could do that without our banking and our technological skills when it comes to investment. So they rely totally on us.
Thank you. Now, Peter, what should I be doing with my mortgage company right now?
You should put the houses on the market, and if you could find someone dumb enough to buy it and someone dumb enough to finance the transactions, you should sell. The fact of the matter is, the economy hasn't been humming. All we've been doing is going on a consumption binge, just like the heroin addict. These numbers are false. All they're measuring is how much wealth we're dissipating, not how much we're producing.
We're
borrowing money from the Japanese and the Chinese to buy the products that they produced on credit. We are going to go through a painful correction. Anybody that thinks that we're going to go from such a wide, out of whack imbalance, and all of a sudden we're just going to turn a little switch and it's going to be like a little, not a big deal, is fooling themselves. It's, just like when people told me, when I said the NASDAQ's going to drop 80 to 90%, of course I was right. Oh, no, it's only going to go down 10% or 15%. No way. We are way out of balance. We're not going to have a little mild recession. This is a major economic contraction that's coming, and the real estate market and the mortgage market is right in the forefront.
All right, we're going to take one more question in the interest of time. I'm sorry, sir, in the back. You've had yours. Yes, sir?
Yes. You talked earlier about how there were forecasts made last year. I'd like to hear before he leaves what Peter's forecasts were and how they've gone about during the past year, and then to have each of you, where do each of you think the Dow will be 1 year from now and the 10-year Treasury will be 1 year from now?
Good question. Peter?
Well, when I was here last year, I didn't make any forecasts, I don't think, on the Dow. I made forecasts on real estate, and I predicted that the market would go down, and it has gone down. I predicted that the bubble was in the process of bursting, and it has. The question now is how much air was in it and how much is going to come out. And I think it's still got a long way to go. And, you know, when you mention those statistics about adjustable rate mortgages, the problem is they're all concentrated in the high-priced markets. I think something like 54% of the value of mortgages in the United States is adjustable rate because they're all concentrated in the high-priced markets. It's a huge problem. What's going to happen to the Dow? You know, the market's been rising in nominal terms. There's a tremendous amount of inflation. So I don't even care if the Dow goes up or down in nominal terms. The Dow is losing value as we speak. It has been losing value for 7 years. If you adjust the Dow for the CPI, it would have to be at 14,000 right now, even if you take the government's numbers as accurate. If you figure the government CPI is understating inflation by 2 to 3% a year, which I think is conservative, the Dow would need to be at 16,000 right now to have the same purchasing power it had in 2000. The Dow right now is about a third below where it was in 2000 in terms of the euro. It's about 25% below where it was in 2000 in terms of the British pound or the Australian or Canadian dollar. The Dow is less than half of where it was in 2000 priced in gold. And if you want to price it in zinc or lead or nickel or copper or oil, it's even worse. So the Dow is losing value against just about anything else that you can own, and I think that's going to continue to be the case. Long-term interest rates eventually going sky high. I don't know where they'll be next year, but eventually rates are going to Pluto. They're not just going to the moon, they're going to Pluto.
Pluto's not a planet anymore, so I'm
sure. Well, I know, whatever it is, a planetoid.
All right, last comment by Barry Asmus.
I think Peter's scenario would come true if an atomic bomb landed on either Los Angeles, Chicago, or New York. Now, if I think that happened, and that's not beyond the realm of possibility for sure, if that happened, this scenario would unfold. It would take that kind of an exogenous event. But when you are a $12 trillion economy, very, very productive, and the labor force doubling its productivity in the last years, of course there's going to be some correction, of course there's going to be some softness, and of course some people are going to get burned. But to the degree that Peter said, I don't buy a bit of it, and so once again, we're all going to have to get together next year. And by the way, as much as I disagree with Peter, he's really a neat guy. Take it from me.
As both of you are. Ladies and gentlemen, help me thank Peter Schiff and Dr. Barry Asmus.